This episode is sponsored by Catan Studio. Episode 39 of the Board Game Geek Podcast, where we geek out about board games, the mechanisms behind them, and the people who create them. I'm your host, Candace Harris, and I am so pumped to be here today with Efka from No Pun Included YouTube channel and the Talk Cardboard Podcast. How's it going today, Efka?
It's going pretty great. Hello, I am Efka from the No Pun Included YouTube channel and Talk Cardboard Podcast. Candace, I wanted to ask you, always wanted to ask you, in the intro music, is that you on drums?
Yes, that is.
Sweet.
That is actually a song. It wasn't a full song that I ever wrote. Maybe one day I'll finish it. But like, I used to write a lot of ideas for one of my bands, and sometimes the ideas didn't become songs. So I've been trying to like, for any shows I do, I try to like incorporate music that I've done, but that's actually all me, like bass, drums, vocals.
Oh, wow.
And my partner, Matt, helped me like mix it a little better because I'm a rough recorder when it comes to production. But I like the lo-fi kind of dirty, like I would sometimes like make beats on my desk and like put a mic on my desk and then put distortion on it and, you know, do like experimental stuff like that. But yeah, that's all, that's me.
I'm all about lo-fi.
Cool. Yeah, well, Efka, it's great to be talking to you today because I kicked off the podcast this year with Elaine on here. And I know like the three of us have been talking about doing something together since last year when we connected at Essen. So I'm so excited to finally have the other half of No Pun Included here.
I know. So you invited us both ages ago. I think it was like, you know, we were talking at Essen Spiel, we should do this.
Right,
and then
right.
You emailed in November. So I've been anticipating recording this with you since November.
That's awesome. Well, I am, as I told Elaine, have been a big fan of your channel and everything you two do for a long time. So it's nice to finally like actually know each other and, you know, get to bump into each other at Essen like that.
Yeah. And Elaine told me that we've actually bumped into each other in the past before as well, haven't we?
Yes, there was a interesting nighttime encounter in 2019. Where you two were outside the hotel and you had just played Magic Maze on Mars, which I told Elaine, like, what happened to that game? It just never came out.
I mean, that's the story of Essen. So many games, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like they appear and then disappear.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, how's everything going? What's new in your world?
Can you believe it? Board games. They keep coming in.
What?
And like, it's just no stopping them. I put a sign on the door that says, no more board games, please. Didn't work. Just here.
I had an interesting weekend last weekend because I went to, have you ever heard of a trading card game called Flesh and Blood?
I have heard of it, yes.
Okay. Well, Flesh and Blood is a card game that I got like super duper into early last year. I was playing it a lot. And it's really, 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 really awesome. And I interviewed the creator of the game, James White, and they were doing one of their big like pro tour competitive events in LA last weekend. So he hit me up and said, hey, I'd love to like finally meet you in person, you know, and I'm like, oh my goodness, I'm, you know, how could I not go? You know, there are people flying from all around the world. The company that Legend Story Studios, they're based in New Zealand. So it's like, you know, this was kind of a rare opportunity for me to actually be able to meet these folks. So I went over there and beyond going over there, they live stream their like main event matchups. And their live stream production is really, really good. And they'll have two people like narrating it like you're watching like a MMA match or like a boxing match where it's just like, oh no, he's gonna play this card, but the only thing they can respond with is that card. Oh, they have that card. Oh my gosh. You know, like it's this, like, it's so entertaining. I bet, like, even if somebody who doesn't play board games at all, like, watch these live streams, you would be, like, so engaged because of how the hosts are, the announcers are just, like, telling the story, and it's, like, very tense, kind of, like, chess-like gameplay. So, like, during the weekend, like, when I wasn't there, I was, like, watching the live stream a lot to see what was going on. It was really cool because the top eight, so the best eight players in the competition – were from eight different countries. I was like, that's wild. So this is like, you know, I never got into like Magic or anything like that, but like I could not believe how massive this event was. You know, it's at the convention center in LA, just like seas of tables of people playing cards. There was like a cosplay contest, which was really cool. And, you know, have you ever been to something like this?
Yes, actually. So before I did Nope and Included, I was actually a Magic the Gathering tournament organizer.
Oh, snap! I didn't know that.
Yeah. When I stopped, I just stopped and I'd never looked back, right?
Mm.
But during the time, it was very interesting. Yeah, Magic, even a decade ago, had the same thing. You know, they professionally live stream and televise. You know, yeah, it feels like feels like a sports event, right? And they have commentators and all that kind of jazz. And we even actually covered in one of our videos where we were talking about deck building, we covered a particular Magic the Gathering tournament event. It was a final of a Pro Tour from 2012 with Yue Watanabe and Stanislav Sifka. And that game was very special because basically one of the players, Yue Watanabe, was playing a deck that was completely busted. And the other player sat there and watched, and it was the finals, right? These are the two top players in the world, right?
Wow.
One of them is doing everything. The other one is sitting and watching because they have no opportunity. They're locked out of the game, right?
Wow.
So because they sometimes use dice as counters and because Yuya had so much to track, Stanislav got so bored, he assisted his opponent with like moving the dice counters like back and forth and whatever.
Like because making himself useful in some way.
Yeah, like what do I do, right? And we were making videos about combos and why combos are interesting and why they're not, right? And that seemed like the, you know, most kind of well-known example of a like a pretty much televised event of one person just, you know, having the time of their life, probably, right? And and the other person's just like,
bored.
Yeah, cool.
Wow. Yeah, this was like, with a lot of these Flesh and Blood matchups, it would just wow me. Like, somebody would get down to one health. And this is a game where your two heroes battling against each other, trying to, like, reduce, you know, trying to kill your opponent. And like somebody would get down to like one or two, you start with 40 life and the other person would have like 35 and you're just like, oh, he's dead. And it's like, no, he's ticking him down. He's doing something. Mm. And there was just so many surprises and cool moments. And
it's exciting.
It's really exciting. And it's like also really exciting to see people playing at that level of skill. Like, I could take their same, you know, you and I could take their same decks that they were playing with and just not be able to, like, be in that headspace, that skill level, like, knowing those cards well or whatever, to, like, play at the level that they're playing, you know, without some practice and everything.
Yeah, I think you, if you're a part of that life, you have to live that life. And that's why they're called lifestyle games, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's probably why I pivoted to board games, because for me, the sense of discovery is so much more enjoyable and the sense of variety and, you know, experimentation. Not to say that that doesn't exist in trading card games, but also I feel like overall I don't know. Trading card games are seeing a massive resurgence right now. There just seems to be so many that are coming out
and
that
Star
are doing
Wars Unlimited.
Really well. Right. Yeah.
Lorcana, right?
Yeah. And then the altered one as well.
Oh yeah. With the QR codes.
And like people, you know, don't even know if it's going to be good or not. But like doing gangbusters, right?
Yeah. Well, that certainly like reinvigorated my love of Flesh and Blood, you know. So I'm I'm working on building a new deck around this assassin hero. Her name is Azuri, and she has this like really cool ability where you can play these stealth cards. And if I attack you with a stealth card, you have to decide how much you want to block, because my ability as an assassin, I can do this switcheroo kind of thing and like actually swap that card out with another one. And it just seems really fun. And like, I love kind of mind games in any game. So like, for me to like play something like that, see how, if you want to like over block, because one of the things that I love about Flesh and Blood is the incredibly hard decision of when to use cards to defend, because you don't draw back. If it's not your turn as the attacker, you won't draw back. And you're usually dealing with like a hand of four cards. So it's like, if you spend two cards to defend, you're only going to have maybe two cards to do something to attack back. And then it's like trying to like work that tempo, decide when you want to do this versus when you want to just take the damage so you can like turn around. Anyway,
there's an economy to it, right?
Yeah. There's an economy to it. I'm just like really fascinated by it. And the other thing that I really like about it that stands out is how thematic it is for a card game. Like, all of the different heroes, like the play styles are different. You have like different equipment and different cards in your deck that will feel thematic. Like the Rangers, you have to like load an arrow into your quiver before you fire it. You can't just, you know, throw a bow at somebody, you know? So there's like all these things that they've built into the flavor of it with the mechanisms that like makes it feel like really thematic also. So anyway,
that sounds really interesting. Have you ever played Worldbreakers, by the way?
I have not played Worldbreakers. I backed it. I set it up one day, started learning it, and then never ended up playing it. So I took it down and I haven't revisited.
You should try it. It's really good. It's strange. It like when you read the rules, it doesn't seem like it's doing anything interesting, but like there's some really juicy considerations there. I really enjoyed playing that. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I'll have to break that out, because I have that one and I have Earthborn Rangers. I mean, that's different type of card game, but they're both games that I back that I haven't actually dug into yet. So you're inspiring me to do that.
Good. I might inspire you to play the other one in a second as well.
Nice. All right, Efka, well, today we're not here to just talk about card games, are we?
No.
So I'm sure a lot of people who listen to this podcast probably know, but some people probably don't know, but on Board Game Geek, every game has a ranking. And there's always a lot of talk and controversy about the games that are ranked in the top 100. So I originally proposed the idea of Efka and I possibly talking about our favorite games that are currently ranked in the top 100. And Efka was like, no, Candace, I want to flip this upside down and all around. So today we're going to discuss our favorite board games that we think should be ranked in VGG's top 100.
Right. Let's inject some of ourselves into that top 100.
I love it. I think that's a great idea. And it definitely gave me some more food for thought, because obviously there are a lot more games not in the top 100 than are in the one top that are in the top 100. You know what I'm trying to say. But anyway, before we start talking about games that we think should be ranked in VGG's top 100, I'd love to hear what you've been playing lately, Efka, since you have all these games coming to your house. So let's jump into Fresh Plays.
Well, Candace, I have been playing Earthborn Rangers.
Oh, yes. Awesome. Tell me about it. Tell me.
It's really good. It's very good. It's not for, it's so not for everyone. It's such, I think it's going to be a very divisive game because it's so slow. It is so monumentally slow, but it needs to be slow because it's the, no pun intended, nature of the game, right?
Yeah.
So Earthborn Rangers is a game where you are, it's like those, you know, CCGs, you know, like Magic or whatever, but cooperative and more like the, I don't think there's a difference because it's only a distribution model, but like LCGs, right? Where it's
right.
Like a living card game. So they did the Lord of the Rings one and the Arkham Horror, card game. Yep. Yeah. Well, a lot of people that worked on those have also worked on Earthborn Rangers, except it's not Fantasy Flight Games anymore. And it's kind of got that, you know, same structure to it. But actually, I think that's very deceptive. Because if you say to people, oh, this is like those, you know, they're going to come in with expectations and then they're going to start playing it. And it's a game set in a kind of a, I call it like post-apocalyptic because the apocalypse has been and gone and the world is, you know, like rebuilding and more in tune with environment. And, you know, like, so it's got like that sort of solar punk energy. But Andrew Navarro, I did interview him, who is the lead publisher and I think one of the lead designers on the game. You know, he said it's not technically solar punk, but it's got those vibes, you know. So, you know, in you playing Rangers of the Valley and, you know, you travel around the settlements and offer assistance and whatnot, right? And, okay, that makes sense as a pitch. And then you sit down and start playing and you go, I don't know what to do with this. Like, this card's on the table, right? And this card's in my hand. And the cards on the table are like, you know, oh, there's a deer and there's a wolf and I need to deliver some, like, the first mission is literally, deliver some biscuits. Okay. I guess I will, right? And you're like, I don't understand how these mechanisms do things. Like, I understand how they work and function. Right. I know the rules, right? But if I play this card that makes tea, right? What has that got to do with anything? What has that got to do with the wolf that's in the way? Is it in the way? Because it's like in my vicinity, so it must be doing something, right?
Right, right.
And then you sort of just like kind of go through the motions and you try things. And then the game very slowly starts to unfurl. And what starts happening is that the environment that, because you keep drawing these path cards and they come out and they start populating the various areas. So like each ranger has their own area called within reach and there's the further area along the way. And then there's the location areas and whatever, right? And so all these path cards come out into these areas and they might be like flora, for example, you know, there's some brambles or whatever. And there might be like, oh, there's a deer or there's a wolf thing, you know? Here's this person, or here's this notable location, right? But they all have these triggers. And anytime you do a test, you'll have to draw a challenge card. And on top of telling you whether, you know, like what kind of modifier you get towards your test, you'll get also one of three symbols. And all these cards can do something if those symbols come out and they start interacting with each other. The wolf eats the deer, and then the wolf itself also gets trapped by some sort of acidic bioslime that starts eating it, right? And the bioslime is distracted, and then you run away, right? And then you know, you get to the area where you need to deliver the biscuit, and it's like, oh, right, okay. So like, it needs a lot of time for you to understand what your deck actually does.
Gotcha.
And kind of like how you can manipulate things. And it needs a lot of time to kind of understand how this environment works with each other. And a lot of it is trial and error. A lot of it is trying to do something and just watching what happens. And so it's a very slow observational game. But within that, it's like very rewarding because you feel like you are learning this environment. You are learning how everything works and like, I don't know. Like, the game has highs and lows, but even when it has like these lows, I go, okay, that wasn't very good or whatever. But there's this curiosity within me that's just very tempted by by the exploration and by, you know, by what I can discover. And not even like discover, because you sort of broadly understand what you'll encounter, but how these things are going to like function with each other, right?
Cool.
It's very strange and very slow and methodical, and it rewards patience. But yeah, it's something else. It's Ooh. Like nothing I've ever played, you know?
Oh, cool.
Yeah, excited.
I was like really curious about that whole open world exploration element of it too. Are you playing it with Elaine or are you playing it solo? Okay, just the two of us.
Yeah.
Cool.
Solo is weird because the thing about solo in that game is that the more players there are, right, the more of that environment comes out every turn and the more of it interacts, right? So with one, there's not a lot of that happening, right? And with four, I haven't played it with four, but I imagine it's chaos because, you know, everything triggers all the time.
Yeah. I think I would probably do it with two as well. We're revisiting a lot of, you were bringing up Lord of the Rings, LCG and Arkham Horror, but we're revisiting Lord of the Rings right now. And just, I love it. I love it so much. And I can't wait to try Earthborn Rangers. I was also kind of thinking about when you were talking about the animals and everything and not quite knowing what to do, it was making me think about Kingdom Death Monster. Mm. I've never played it before, but I picked up a copy from someone, got a bit of a deal on a copy that had painted minis and everything, and I haven't tried it yet, but I'm kind of very curious about that game in terms of like kind of just how things will unravel, because, you know, I hear that you just kind of get dropped in this dark world and, you know, you're half naked and you just got to like figure things out. Have you ever played that?
No, I've not. I'm familiar with it, but I've never played it. But yeah, I imagine from what I know of that game, there is some similarity in that. Yeah. But this is a lot more, I think Kingdom Death seems like a game that has just a lot of variety in what can happen, right?
Whereas, oh, yeah, with their like combat system, how the animals respond,
Earthborn Rangers is very specific. It's like, you know, like once you've been to the woods once, you know how the woods function, right?
Gotcha.
And then you go to the lake area and, that's how lakes function, right? And every new area is kind of a little bit of a surprise. But within that, like that's kind of the beauty of it. It's that you learn the environment. Right? You take time to understand and appreciate the environment. It's very thematic in that way.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Efka. So now Earthborn Rangers and Worldbreakers both need to bust them both out.
Good.
That's awesome. The first game I'm going to bring up is a game that I won it in a Price is White Elephant contest.
Okay.
Earlier this year, so I got it for free because I guess the pricing of it, the current Amazon pricing on it, I don't even remember what it is, but it's called Divinity Derby, and this is a 2017 release designed by Carlo Rossi. It's from Ares Games, and it's a betting and racing game for 3 to 6 players. I don't remember exactly which episode, but at some point I talked about a game called The Rich and the Good, which the original version was called Hob and Gut. I don't know if you ever played that before.
No.
Okay. Well, the hook with that game, that's like kind of a stock market game where you have a shared hand of cards between your left and right neighbor. And that in that game, you were like manipulating a market and you're trying to buy shares and sell them at the right time. And you want to donate to charity because it had like a high society thing, where whoever donates the least to charity cannot win the game, even if you had the most money at the end. Well, this game came out after the fact, but Carlo used this same shared hand management system. And it's really cool because I guess I think I've discovered that I like betting racing games better than straight up racing. Like I just like when everybody can kind of manipulate the racers but we're making bets on who we think is going to win or lose or whatever. So in this game, you're racing with mythological creatures, and before the race starts, I think there are There might be a certain number of creatures every game. I believe maybe 6, 8. I don't remember exactly. But before the race starts, you're going to each place 2 bets, one at a time in turn order. And to bet, everybody starts the game with like a hand of like 10 or so betting cards. And the betting cards are like, I think this whoever I bet on is going to win first, second, or third. And if they place first, second, or third, you might get 4 coins or whatever. I think this person's going to be last. I think this person's going to be disqualified or first place. So like there are different cards that you'll play. And when you make a bet, you're going to first look at your hand of cards. And the shared hand of cards is basically standees. So between me and the person on my left, we have a standee with like 8 cards that we can see. And then the person on my right, we have a standee of 8 cards that we can both see. So everybody can see 2 trays of cards, and you're kind of making your initial bets based on these cards, because these cards are going to be played to move the animals or the creatures, these creatures. So let's say I bet like, okay, Pegasus is going to come in first or be disqualified. And I say why can't I think of another one right now?
A manticore.
Sure, manticore is going to come in last place. So I'm going to take these tokens and put them on these cards face down. People know that I bet on those creatures, but they don't know which of my betting cards that I put, like whether I think they're going to do well or not, or somewhere in between. So everybody does this. Then we start the race. And the way the race works is on your turn, you're going to play 2 cards, one from each card tray, the one on your right and the one on your left. One of the cards that you play is going to move one of the creatures fast. It's fast movement. So each card has a creature on it and a fast movement and a slow movement number. So like, okay, maybe I'm like, I want Pegasus to win. So I'm going to move, or maybe I want something else to lose more specifically. If I see a lot of people are doing something, I'll say I'll move that one slow. So maybe they move 0 or 1 or something like that. But then Pegasus that I'm betting on, I'm going to say, let's move fast. You have to kind of be cautious because sometimes your neighbors will be seeing what you're seeing and they'll be like trying to help you. But other times they might see what you're doing and they might play one of that creature's cards slowly just so you can't play it quickly. So there's like a lot going on with your decisions and like looking around the table to see how other people are placing bets. But one of the things I love about this game is that some of the cards for the fast movement have this boosted, like, I forget if it's called like risky movement value, where like maybe I could move Pegasus 3 and be fast, but I could add +3 and it's a risky move. So I'm actually moving Pegasus 6. What happens there is instead of discarding the card after I play it, I put it in this like risky pile where like they might be disqualified at the end of their So anyway, you get to a halfway point when one of the creatures crosses the halfway point, we all place one more bet and then we just play the rest of the cards and wherever the creatures fall rank-wise, I think there's 6 of them. You line them up. So everybody's there 1 through 6, but anybody who did those risky movements, those cards are going to get shuffled in with these 3 other kind of like neutral cards, and you're going to flip 2. So you're randomly possibly disqualifying 2 creatures, or, you know, 1 creature might have multiple cards, something, or nobody's disqualified. So that's like one of the bets you can make that someone is going to be disqualified, but that will shift. So let's say Pegasus was 1. In first place, and then Pegasus gets disqualified. Now somebody else is in first place because everything shifts.
Right.
Yeah. So it's this really like I've been having like a lot of fun with it, like especially 4 to 6 players. You know, it takes about an hour to play, but it's something really easy to learn. The version that I have has like painted minis. I think it was a Kickstarter version or something. So I kind of got hooked up. But I just love that, like, that shared hand of cards mechanism where it's like everybody has 2 hands to get some data on. And like, how do you make your decisions based on that to make bets? So it's just this like I don't know, a fun game. And to me, like, when I, after I played it the first time, I was like, I'm going to sell my Rich and the Good, because I think I like what this game does better with that same hand system, which I'm assuming Carlo probably thought that when he was like, let me design this new version, you know?
Yeah.
So have you heard of this one before?
No, but I'm getting very big Winner's Circle vibes.
I never played Winner's Circle.
I like to describe it as Reiner Knizia's roll and move game, which is obvious. It's very not that, but.
Oh, wait a second. Is this like an old horse game?
Yeah, okay.
I did play it once because I think Aldi was running a game at like BGG Con. He's like, you have to try this. Well, whoops, I totally forgot. I have played that then.
Yeah, it used to be called Royal Turf. And it's quite old. It's from 2001. But it's been reprinted by, I want to say, Dice Tree Games in a very kind of lavish version. It's quite nice. I really like it. There's a simplicity to it that, like, there's just a bunch of cards and all those cards move horses, but you select which horse you move with that card when you roll the die. Because you roll the die, you get a choice of one card, but you get to choose which horse you're going to move.
Oh.
And then the values are so different, right? Like, and so whatever you bet on, you could deliberately, for example, move the horse that you didn't bet on, but with a card that's like super slow, and it's like, ah, ha, ha, you know? So I think it's got a similar vibe to what you're describing, but there's a simplicity to it where it's just like, who you're going to move and how much and, you know, that kind of thing.
And then in this one, the added wrinkle of somebody might be disqualified. We're not going to know till the end. Like, I always love that reveal at the end. But people who don't like randomness like that might not enjoy that. But it's a silly, fun game. You know, it's not trying to take itself too seriously. But yeah, that's my first game, Divinity Derby. What else have you been playing, Efka?
I've been playing some Arcs. Not a lot, but just dip my toes into Arcs.
Nice.
Yeah. I presume you've played it, right?
I played it once. Cole had a pre-production copy at San Diego History Con, and I got in a game there, and I really, 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 really liked it.
I really liked it, too. I played it on TTS, actually, with everybody's friend Tom Brewster, who's so obsessed with it. He was like, can we just play it? Like, let's play it on TTS. I'm like, okay.
Sure.
It's been a while since I've used that piece of software, but let's it's so weird but good. Like, we didn't actually manage to finish our game because Tom had to go somewhere, but even like two-thirds of it in, I was feeling something that, like, I haven't quite experienced before, in a way that it's hard to put your finger on, but I think I'm starting to put my finger on it. I think what's special about it is that so many space kind of area control games focus on that sort of like building an empire, you know, aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is so very clearly not doing that. It feels like it's trying to make like a world populated with characters, and you are literally one of these characters, and you don't know what you are yet when you start playing, because you know, everyone's sort of the same. I know there's like variants where you can introduce some initial personality, but everyone's the same, but you discover who you are through play, which is very interesting. And you find yourself, like, you know, seeing those familiar tropes of, like, if you read a lot of sci-fi, space sci-fi, and I do. So I'm starting to kind of like recognize some of the tropes and familiarities of these characters that are not like these cookie cutter characters, but like more complex characters with like their own, like, not heroes' journeys, but more interesting journeys, you know? And I'm like, okay. Things are happening here. And on top of that, there's that, you know, whole trick-taking thing that drives everything, which I really shouldn't say trick-taking, because I think if you call it a trick-taking game, you're leading people down the wrong path. It's not
right.
Yeah, It uses elements of trick taking.
A trick taking mechanism for action selection.
Yeah. Brian Boru comes to mind. I don't know if you played that or
yes.
not.
Yes, yes, I yeah. have. Yep.
I really quite like that game. I think yeah. it's quite good. But
yeah,
but
me too.
It's bizarre because it's like, oh, it's trick taking, but it's not
a trick taking game. No, but it has that yeah.
yeah. But yeah, there's so much going on in ARX that I don't think I'm gonna, you know, spend more time describing it because I don't know, even from that, you know, two thirds of a play, I could just, you know, rabbit on for hours. But
yeah.
Yeah, no, very, very interesting, very compelling.
I really liked the way that the players drive what scores each round.
Yeah.
And how the combat is just on the active player. And you have those like different types of dice that you can select.
Yeah, 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 yeah. It's like you make all the choices. And it's like, yeah. Oh, but I'm in this combat and I don't like it.
Right. and it just yeah for a game that has that epic, you know, space opera type feel, it's, you know, it's not all that long, and I just love games where you have to pay attention to what other people are doing all the time. And I liked this system of how you get I can't remember what the type of cards are, but you like put your people or like spies yeah. on cards,
you put
or something
your influence
like that.
On it or something. Yeah yeah, yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
I thought that was neat too.
That was the big narrative driver, because like the first card, because I was kind of boxed out of good actions on my first round because you know, trick taking card draws right matters
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, let's pivot. Let's maybe look at some of these cards, and like I don't quite, you know, it's my first play. I don't quite yet understand what they're doing and what's happening. So I picked up a card that was called Fuel Cartel. And I found myself in a certain role within the game, because the next thing I got was like some fanatical guards. And I'm like, there's some storytelling happening here. You know, and I had to pick that up because it makes sense. Because it, you know, like the Fuel Cartel was the thing that made me have like control of the fuel resources, which like I couldn't do anything with them, but they counted for various scoring things. They were
right.
Like I literally took them from the center of the board and plopped them onto my board. I'm like, haha, they're here now, right? So that's cool, right? I'm like, okay, but if someone takes that card away from me, and if you attack someone, you can raid the other player's stuff and take their cards or whatever. Mm. I'm like, I need to protect that. So the next thing I got was the card that stopped that from happening. And I'm like, like this makes sense mechanically and thematically, and
right.
it's emergent, right? Like that wasn't orchestrated; that just happened naturally. And I immediately was like, "Okay, this is very different from like any space game out there," and
totally.
And I really appreciate that.
Yeah, yeah, I'm definitely excited to dig into that, and the campaign seems really interesting too. I'm curious about that as well.
I had to flip through it. I'm not getting a sense for what it's going to be, but mm-hmm. I'm getting a sense for like even more of that kind of storytelling, and you know, yeah, maybe a bit more of a prescribed path. But like, it looks like you also have a lot of ability to pivot, so that's interesting
cool.
too.
Cool, cool. All right. Well, that is ARX. So the next game I'll bring up is something that I've been dabbling with solo. And it's a game called 20 Strong from Chip Theory. And Chip Theory Games sent me a copy of this. This was a release from 2023. It's a new solo game system. And you play each game with a different deck of cards. So right now there are three different games that exist for 20 Strong. There's like the one that comes with the core system, which is called Solar Sentinels, and then they have a Too Many Bones version, and then they have a Hoplomachus Victorum version. But this game is designed, I think the system was designed by Josh Carlson, and then I know they have credits for Ryan Howard, Salem Scott, and Shannon Wedge for the Too Many Bones one. I don't know who developed the Hoplomachus one, but we'll just say the Chip Theory team. And basically this game, when you get it, it'll come with 20 dice. So you have three dice that are stat dice, Like one's going to be representing your life, your heart. Another represents something called like your, I think, strategy level. And then the other is a recovery, like how many dice you're going to be able to recover after you've exhausted dice from using them. And this is a very dicey game, everybody. So if dice are not your thing, fast forward in the next 5 minutes. But it comes with the 20 dice. It comes with a dial, which you use in some games in different ways. And then again, you'll play with a deck of cards. And regardless of which one you play, you're going to play as a hero. Each hero has like some special ability. Each game has like a lot of different heroes that you can choose from. And you're going to be battling enemies that are represented by like conflict cards, they're called. And they're going to be in stacks. You're going to have stacks of cards. You're going to pick enemies, activate them, pick which dice you want to roll. The dice have different strengths. So like the yellow dice only have, I think, 3 hits on them and maybe 1 critical hit, 2 hits and misses. And then it goes all the way up to like the red die, which you only have 1 of those, but it hits, I think, every single time. And one of the things that like I really like all the love and attention to detail that Chip Theory puts into their production. But one of the things that's really cool is that each die, besides it being a different color, there's an icon like on the miss side that tells you how many hits are on the die. So again, on the yellow die, there's a circle with like 3 notches. That means there's 3 hits on that. The next die, the green one, is going to have 4 notches on the circle. So you don't have to take the die and be like, wait, how many hits are on here? And, you know, spin it. I think that's so clever and like really kind of essential for this kind of game. But you have these different color dice that you're going to be playing. And a lot of this strategy wise is going to be like figuring out which dice you want to use when, because dice that you're using to attack are going to kind of become exhausted. And you're only going to be able to like recover a certain amount, like maybe 2 at the start of the game each time. And a lot of it is like you're managing your dice pool. And then also, there are a lot of like really cool decisions that come from which conflict card you want to activate, because you're going to each round activate a conflict card. Sometimes, you know, a lot of them have effects. So it might say, hey, now you need to, add 2 more to this fight or whatever. You know, maybe when you activate this card, there's something happens to you, or after you fight this card, something happens to you. But most of the cards, the conflict cards, also have a reward on the bottom that are either like an immediate effect, like maybe it'll update one of your stats, like your health or your recovery value, or it'll be some kind of like ongoing ability it can give you if you successfully like defeat that enemy. Or sometimes it's just like a single use kind of reward. But you can only hold a certain amount of items depending on your like strategy number. Your strategy number is also representing how many times you can kind of roll, I guess, like engage with the enemies, like kind of like having more attempts to defeat someone. So all of these stats are kind of important to tick up. If your health ever goes down to 0, you lose the game. And the way you win the game, regardless of which one you're playing, is you're going to have some like boss enemy at the end that you're going to have to work your way to, fight this boss. And if you beat the boss, you win. So it's like a very streamlined system. Activate card, pick some dice, roll some dice, clean up. You know, do that over and over again. But each game within this system has so like plays so differently for that kind of like core mechanism. Like, so the Solar Sentinels one is this like sci-fi theme. You're like this fighting force trying to save Earth from an alien horde. It's definitely, I would say, probably the simplest of the 3 to play. And then you have some missions you're trying to achieve, but you have these 3 stacks of enemies and you could pick which one. So you have a decision of like, what do I go for? Because you have to clear one of these stacks completely before you can go and target the boss enemy. So, you know, you might be like, oh, I'm just always going to pick from this column. But no, maybe I want the reward from the enemy on this one. or maybe I'm afraid of this one because this is just like, you know, if I can't beat him, he's going to kill me or whatever. So that's the Solar Sentinels one. Then the Too Many Bones ones. You played Too Many Bones, right, FK?
Yeah.
So this feels like a very stripped down version of Too Many Bones. Like,
right.
You have a gear lock. You have your gear lock has like an innate ability that you can upgrade like via your backup plan. And you have different encounters. So the stacks of cards, you have like encounters, and then you have 1-point baddies and 5-point baddies. And then you have a tyrant, and they have, you know, the game comes with several tyrants that you can pick to make your boss. And, you know, I mentioned there was a dial that comes with the game. In the Too Many Bones scenario, just like the game, you're going to tick up the dial to go through different days. And once you hit a certain amount of days, that's when you can start taking on the main tyrant boss.
Just like Too Many Bones. Yeah.
But in your encounter deck, you have these tyrant encounters. And the more of them you can get through successfully before you go to get try to take down the tyrant, the easier it will be to fight the tyrant because it kind of like those beef them up. So you have this decision of like, do I go for an encounter? Do I just do a regular battle to take care of these baddies? You can scout. So anyway, that one's really cool, especially if you like Too Many Bones already, because it.
That was going to be my question. Favorite. Like, does it feel actually like?
Yeah, you know, yeah. I think it does. I think it does have that flavor of like, hey, I'm on day 8, so now I need to take a 5-point baddie and 2 3-point or 2 3-1-point baddies, and you know, like how that kind of like your battling scales up. You have different encounters that give you an option of battle versus doing some other kind of like challenge, just like in Too Many Bones. You know, like maybe it'll be like, oh, you could do this battle, or you could do this thing where you take 2 of each color dice and you try to, you know, achieve something. And then the lock picking can give you access to like cool items. And
they even put the lock picking in. Wow.
They put the lock picking in. Yeah. And then you can kind of extend your backup plan. So you have a backup plan ability. And like that's a way for you to leverage these dice that you're rolling misses on. So yeah, to me, it has like a lot of like Too Many Bones feel to it for this like stripped down deck of cards with some dice. And probably I would say, I mean, it's too early to really say, but I would say the one I was most excited about, even though I love Too Many Bones, is the Hoplomachus Victorum one. Because this is like, I don't know if you've played Hoplomachus at all or Hoplomachus Victorum.
Okay. I have some opinions.
Okay. Have you played Victorum or just the like
just Victorum?
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Do you want to share those opinions?
We made a video about it actually. it was not very favorable. I didn't like it at all.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, maybe you'll like this version because this is once again a stripped down version of Hoplomachus Victorum. So what I like, so for people who don't know that game, it's a gladiator theme. And in this version, so your hero is this like gladiator. One of the things I liked with this one is during the setup, you pick randomly pick 4 heroes, right? Hmm. And then you get to choose who you want to be as a hero from those 4 cards. The other 3, you flip them over and they become the primuses that you're going to have to take down before you get to the main boss, who's the Scion. And the other thing that I thought was like clever about this version of 20 Strong is that you put stacks of cards that the stacks of cards have 3 different types, like bloodshed events, sport events, and opportunities. But you have like stacks of 6 cards, but it's in a pyramid, like a mountain. And you're actually like moving around like
not a physical pyramid, right? You don't have to build a pyramid out of cards.
No. Flat.
Okay.
A flat pyramid. Like the bottom row will have 4 stacks, 3 stacks, 2 stacks. Mm-hmm. And then the main Scion is at the very top. So it's like simulating you're traversing this mountain, Mount Vesuvius, and you're, you know, doing these different challenges and eventually hopefully beefing up your abilities and your dice pool to then take on these primuses. And once you've, you know, taken on those primuses, then you take on the main person. I lost all 3 of these games, by the way. I found them to be pretty challenging, even though they have ways to make it more difficult. I think I don't know. I guess that's expected for your first game, or maybe I'm just not great at it. But yeah, I thought that
But that's good, right? That yeah, like you want solo games. Yeah, you don't want to win immediately. Yeah,
exactly. You know, I know that I feel like I could go back and do a little better, hopefully. But I mean, they're still dice. They're still dice. You know. Mm-hmm. So there is that aspect to it. There are things you can do, obviously, to mitigate, and like lots of decisions you can make to minimize your risk in certain situations. But another thing that I liked about this system, besides the fact that it's a system and I love systems, is that it's so compact. The game itself takes up space on the table, don't get me wrong. Mm. But like to travel, if I was going on a trip somewhere and I was like, hey, I want to just take a solo game, the box is like this big, you know?
Yeah,
and
that's
not huge. You have all your dice, you throw one of your decks, whatever deck you want to bring in there, and you have a cool solo experience. Each of them seem like they have like a ton of replay value because they have different heroes, different baddies, the order that certain cards are going to come out. I was really impressed with how so far, and I know they're going to have more games in this system, but like how each game felt different, even though it's like the same core of like activate conflict card, pick some dice, roll them. But then there are mm-hmm. like other things, other rules within the different games. And the components are great. You know, it's got those chip theory cards that are a little slippery, you know?
Yeah.
Familiar. You gotta be careful. be careful with those. And then like a lot of the art is like really, really good. And then they'll have on several of the cards, these like metallic accents and like kind of like holographic metallic accents on cards, which are like very like premium. But yeah, I'm very like much looking forward to seeing like what else they do with this system. I know I did hear whisperings when I was, I think at Gen Con or something, about a couple of the games coming down the pike.
Uh-huh.
And it's exciting, but I think it's a cool, if you don't mind dice, I think it's a cool solo system.
I have a question. So, and apologies to Chip Theory Games for bringing this up, but the only thing I've heard about this game is that the dice smell. Is that true? Do they smell?
The dice, when I first got my copy, they definitely smelled. They had this but it's, to me, it's not like a bad smell. It's definitely an odor. It's almost like, what am I thinking of? Like a, not like the bottom of roller skates. There's some familiar smell, like those bouncy balls when you're a kid, those like rubber balls. Like it smelled like those.
Oh, right. Okay. Oh.
So it's not like, but it was strong though. Like, I was like, let me air these dice out. So, yes, there is that to it, for sure. But, hey, it just depends on what smells you like. Like, I'm one of those weird people who like the smell of gasoline, you know?
Well, yeah, right? Like, people like different things, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it's cool. Like, I think... You know, I was talking about a couple months ago, what was it, Stellarion or one of the games in the Oniverse, those solo games that Shadi Torby makes. Like those and this kind of thing, I think if you're somebody who's out there like that's curious to try something solo to get into solo play, like this is, I think these are both cool because they're small packages. The games aren't like overly complex and there's like a lot of, you know, a lot in that package.
Have you played One Dead Galaxy?
No.
Oh, that's great. That's a solo game as well. It can be played as two, but like it's primarily a solo game, and that's also just like a small box and a lot of dice rolling with a lot of variability. A terrible rule book, a really really bad Galaxy. Rule book. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really good. I really liked it. Oh, it's just cool. A fun dice rolling time solo kind of puzzle, you know, thing.
Yeah,
I think you might enjoy it if you enjoy that kind of thing.
Totally. And it's like sometimes you only have, you know, a certain amount of time to play something solo.
Mm-hmm.
You can't always break out Hoplomachus Victorum.
No. Well, do you know, funny thing is that One Dead Galaxy also has those same slippy cards. Yeah. And they work even worse in that because you have to... You have to do a lot of like overlaying of cards. You have to duck.
Oh.
you have to talk a lot. And I'm like, I'm not doing that. You know, I'm going to keep them to the side because
they're too slippery.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like they feel nice shuffling, but you have to be careful because like that shuffle could just get out of control and the cards just go everywhere, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that is 20 strong Solar Sentinels, Too Many Bones, and Hoplomachus Victorum. And now a word from our sponsor. It's the 21st century and the island of Catan is at a crossroads. Long gone is the agrarian society of the island's Viking ancestors. Today's Catanians need energy to keep society moving and growing, but pollution is wreaking havoc on the island. Catan New Energies is classic Catan with a modern and relevant twist. In this standalone game, you'll harvest and trade resources and build up your society while also managing its growing need for power. You'll start the game using cheap fossil fuels that cause pollution events and interrupt resource production. But as you invest in renewable energy, pollution events are replaced with rewards for sustainable strategies. Catan New Energies is a standalone board game for 3 to 4 players aged 14 and up. It is printed and assembled in the USA of sustainably sourced wood and cardboard using no plastic components. Available for pre-order now on CatanShop.com. All right, Efka, it's time for us to reveal the games that we picked that are BGG's. What?
I thought you were going to say it's time for us to break BGG's top 100.
Oh, yeah. That's even better. Yeah. Let's rewind. All right, Efka. It's time for us to break BGG's top 100.
Yeah.
Yeah. There we go. With picks that we think should be in the top 100. You know, and we should have picked which ones we would take out. How about that?
Yeah, we should have. Yeah. We should, like... Just boot that one out. Yeah.
Yeah. Slap this one in. That might be hard though.
Would get upset.
Yeah. Although maybe not, because I was actually looking and I was seeing there are certain games like I think War of the Ring, which we were talking about. Like War of the Ring, I guess we were talking about that earlier. I don't know if it was on the recording or not, but War of the Ring has two versions, and I think both versions are in the top 100. So it's like
yeah. It's not the only one.
Yeah, they're like there are a couple games that have two editions in there.
Yeah, yeah. My first pick kind of goes over that a little bit.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Cool. So my list, I ended up ranking them from newest in terms of year released to oldest game. Just because I was thinking sometimes new games, you know, need some time to work their way in there. So I was thinking, like, my game that I'll mention first is something that I think will eventually get there. So anyway, that's how I chose to rank mine. I don't know if you did anything specific with yours.
I ranked mine accidentally, apparently, by how close they are to the BGG Top 100. So the first one is the closest.
Okay.
The last one is the furthest away.
Let's see. I was thinking that would be a good way to do it. Mine are all over the place in terms of that. So I went just by year released descending.
I think that makes sense though. You know, like, yeah, like that gives context as to why it's further or closer or whatever. Right.
Right. Well, let's get into it. You had any honorable mentions?
Yeah. I have one honorable mention. Because I don't think it should be on the BGG Top 100, but I'd like for it to be. And this is my favorite game of all time. This is the best game in the world. This is the best game ever made. But it's a game that I love, and I'm not sure. I think rightly, not everyone loves. But it's Sidereal Confluence, and I absolutely adore it. It's published in 2017 by WizKids, designed by Tausetti Dykman. Cover art for the remastered edition is by Quan Chai Moria and illustrations by Nakarin Sukon Takon. Apologies, I butchered that definitely. But yeah, no, I completely amazing space game. Again, a space game that isn't like other space games. And I think it's probably not there because it's such a weird blend. It's real-time trading. Six intense 10-minute rounds of real-time trading followed by intense six rounds of resource conversion.
Right, right.
On a table where someone just spewed some cards, you know, all over the place. Like, I just played a six-player game of it. I say just, like, a couple of months ago. And it didn't fit. It just legitimately did not fit on the table.
With six players.
Yeah, no. We had to squidge and, like, you know, like, tuck cards under other cards. And
yeah.
It was just a mess, right? And that, it is a mess. The game is a mess. It's a glorious mess, and I love it. It ticks every single one of my boxes, and it makes me, like, very pleased because at the heart of it, it's so positive. It's so weirdly non-prescriptive because a lot of board games that kind of lean on popular tropes can be very prescriptive, like, oh, you're this type of alien, you're that, and, you know, and there's right. even an expansion for Sidereal Confluence called Bifurcation that specifically addresses that. It says, hey, these same alien species can have very different philosophies and very different outlooks and, you know, behaviors, and I like that, right? And I like how much the mechanisms make you, it's not that just reflect like what you are, but they make you behave like that kind of person, to the point where there's one faction that's like basically space mafia, and I would warn people against playing that because I've had some very unintentionally fraud experiences where I played that faction and I leaned in a little too hard into the role playing, and that it wasn't
made
good
some enemies.
Yeah, it wasn't good. Like, I think I scarred people a little bit. So that sits on me forever, right? So you have to be careful with that game, right? But also, I don't think it's meant to, like, the game warns you that can happen. So you need to heed that warning, I think. But otherwise, it's got some really funky things like space whales and, you know, being a space whale, what's that like? Well, you can find out by real-time trading and converting resources. It's my thing. It's definitely my thing.
That is, that's a good one. So I've only played Sidereal Confluence once, and I played the remastered WizKids version, and I've been curious about the expansion, but I've only played it once. I played it with five players and had an amazing time. We had, I think we were all new except one person, and we just had a blast with it. And it sits on my game shelf. And, you know, I think that means something, you know, if it's not pushed to the garage or storage or something. It's definitely something I want to revisit. And yeah, you're putting it to the forefront of my brain right now because
I
have such a blast, and it is very different. So that is a good honorable mention. I don't really have honorable mentions. I just had like a couple that I considered for this list, but I'm going to save them for the end because I don't know if any of them might be on your list. And
We'll find out. We'll find out the overlaps, right?
Yep. So you're up first there, Efka.
Okay. Me again. All right. Let's go. So number one, this is the closest. This is at 119. So I think it will get there, right? When I was looking for the list, I noticed that there are only two trick-taking games in the top 100. I might be wrong, but I think there are only two. And both of them are The Crew. Right? How weird is that?
Is The Crew Mission Deep Sea? Isn't that?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Now we got to check. Now we have to check.
We got to check.
Because I think about that? I don't know. I don't remember. But
rank overall 36. So yeah.
Wow.
It's even higher than The Crew.
I mean, it's higher in my head than the original too.
It is, right? It's just a better game, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, The Crew is number 70. So I think that's the only don't quote me in this, but I think that's the only two trick-taking games in the entire top 100. And I think, you know, that has to be remedied. So I don't know how specific you are about nomenclature, but I tend to group climbing shedding games together with trick, because they're part of the same family, right?
Sure, sure. Yeah.
Scout is at 119, and I think it should be there.
Ah, nice.
Published in 2019 by Oink Games, designed by Kei Kajino, art by Ria Komatsuzaki, Jun Sasaki, and Shohei Asaoka. If you've not played Scout, do yourself a favor. It's just such a great game. It's such a great climbing shedding game because I think it embodies everything that climbing shedding is in the most, like, it feels so natural to that genre. Oh yeah, of course, it's like that, right? So if you're not familiar, the idea is that you want to be the first person to get rid of all the cards in your hand, right? And what are the cards in your hand? Well, they're numbers, but the numbers, you see, like, you can't rearrange the cards, right?
Right.
And you can only play higher ranks that have been played on the table. So if someone plays two ones, you have to, you know, like, you have to up that, basically. Or if someone
better
plays
combos,
a run, like, one, two, three, you have to up that, right? So the only variety you have is that, like, on each side of the card, the two numbers are different. So when you get your hand, you can flip the hand one way or the other. That's it. That's the kind of the limitation that you are imposed with. And then so there's so many moments in that game of, like, oh, what have I done? Of course. Right? Like, why did I play that? It's so simple. It's like, it's just almost pure climbing and shedding. There's nothing to it, but it works so well. And it's such a great ambassador for the entire genre, right?
Totally.
And there isn't a climbing shedding game in the top 100. And I think there should be.
Just looking to see if Tichu was in there, because I know that's very popular, but it's
oh,
not.
Yeah. Did I miss Tichu?
No, it's not. It's like 200 something.
Well, there you go, right? I think Scout should
pick.
Be it.
That's a great pick. And yeah, I love in Scout that you can choose to scout. Like, you don't only, you know, and you can flip that card and slot it in your hand wherever you want. So I love that. And you can all of a sudden make something that looks like a garbage hand into something that's a little better. Or you can screw yourself.
Yep. The many times I felt the pain of that. Yeah.
Cool. Scout. Oh, man. That's a good pick. We are starting this off. Okay. Well, so my first game on my list is, again, the newest. It's a game that came out in 2023. I know you like this game. Well, I'm pretty sure you like this game because of a conversation we had earlier before we hit record. Now I'm like starting to question what we've talked about since we've been recording, because we've been pivoting so much. But the first game on my list is Age of Innovation. And Age of Innovation is the new version of Terra Mystica. It came out 2023. It's designed by Helge Ostertag, published by Fjörlin Spiel and Capstone Games. And my copy of the game, you know, I got to do our disclaimers, did come from Capstone Games. But this is a game that I would 100% buy 10 more times just because I love it so much. And I think what it does, it definitely makes Terra Mystica more complex. But, like, I think that Terra Mystica, Gaia Project, all of these games in terms of, like, heavy Euro games are just, like, chef's kiss to me. Like, they are just so, so good. And I think, I'm assuming when more people play this one that it will work its way into the top 100. Because I think that, like, for a lot of people, it's going to replace Terra Mystica. And I know that's not, like, everybody. Go ahead, chime in.
It's so much better than Terra Mystica. It's like, it's all the greatness of Terra Mystica, but better.
Right.
And also, I did want to say, we both picked something with easy boots, right?
Yeah.
Like, Scout boots out one of the crews, right?
Right, right.
And Age of Innovation boots out Terra Mystica.
We're doing well. We do know what we're replacing. But yeah, I just, you know, I'm already a big fan of all of the games in the Terra Mystica world. And yeah, Age of Innovation just kind of knocks it out of the park. And I think, like, for me, like, if I had to dwindle my collection down to, like, 5 or 10 euros or something like that, or 5 or 10 heavy euros, let's say, mm-hmm. like this game would definitely be in there. And I feel like it's just, yeah, it's just so fantastic. Like, I love the player interaction, like how much strategic depth is in this game, how much replay value, you know, now with the way the factions are selected and everything, it's like just off the charts. And then like the skill ceiling is so high, you know? Mm-hmm. And I just love that every round, because of the end of round scoring tiles that change from game to game, every round is like a new puzzle. Like, how can I maximize my points? Oh, I fell behind. What am I going to do to try to get this? Let me try to get this innovation tile and synergize it with this. And, you know, I just love how challenging it is, but how satisfying it is when you're able to like make things work in it.
When things sing in it, it's very special. Yeah. No, Age of Innovation is great. Cool. Yeah. I that's a fantastic pick.
Thank you. All right. What's your next one?
So this is the one where I didn't believe that it wasn't in the top 100. I was like, what? So technically, the pick is Undaunted Normandy, right? Because Undaunted Normandy is not in the top. Your face right now.
My face right now, Efka, because do you want to know what my next game is?
Is it Undaunted Normandy?
Well, it's Undaunted Stalingrad.
Stalingrad, the best one, right?
Yeah, but yeah, like, yeah, I'm yeah. like, all of them, that's so funny.
Well, we can cover them together now,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so this is 2019, published by Osprey Games, designed by Trevor Benjamin, David Thompson, art by Ronald McDonald. I did get a review copy of this back when we were accepting review copies, so disclosure.
Yeah, I think Stalingrad I have a review copy of. I don't remember if Normandy was probably, I don't know, actually, it was so long ago. And Normandy is ranked 165, and yeah. Stalingrad is 1078 right now, 1078.
That's just a mistake. That's a mistake,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I technically picked Normandy because I knew that would be the one that could actually get in there, right?
Right.
But if I had to pick, it would be Stalingrad because it is so much better.
Yeah.
Like, it elevated that game for me so much.
Right. And so what I was thinking about when I put Stalingrad on the forefront, but I literally have, but really any Undaunted game in parentheses, and then I have Normandy too, because for the same reason, like it seems like more of a commercial kind of hit. But if we have like Pandemic Legacy in the top 100, like Stalingrad should be in there, you know, like it's that epic campaign experience that is just like so well done, like in terms of the branching narrative, like how the you know, it's not a legacy game because yeah. you know, but the way that they handle the campaign, it's so cool.
Well, it recontextualizes all the mechanisms. Like, the mechanisms are the same, but they mean different things, mm-hmm. and they mean more interesting things. And that's, I think that's one of the things that made Pandemic Season 1, like Legacy Season 1, so successful. I think people forget that. I've played a lot of Legacy games since Pandemic Legacy Season 1, and I think a lot of them focus on the, oh, you can destroy and you can tear up cards and stickers and write on. That's not what makes that interesting. What right. makes it interesting is like, oh, I've played this before. What does this mean now? Right?
Yeah,
how
yeah.
does that mesh with the narrative? How does this, you know, amalgamate together into this branching story? Oh, Stalingrad did that so well. And a thousand and something mistake.
Yeah. Yeah. It'll get boosted up. It'll get boosted up gradually. But it's, to me, hilarious that we ranked our games in different ways, and then we both happened to pick this game and in the same slot. That's
It probably means that we're not going to have another overlap.
actually, probably not. Probably not. But that's okay. That's okay. That was a good one.
Okay, I have a question then. What are we booting out?
Oh, what are we booting out? I mean, like, what other games have two versions? Well, I think we said War of the... Is Through the Ages in there twice? We don't need the old Through the Ages in there.
No. Yeah. Okay.
We let's just need, put Yeah.
That's a very safe, very diplomatic pick.
Because I'm pretty sure that's one of the games that has two versions in there.
Yeah, there's definitely two through the ages.
Okay, there we go. We'll cut the old one out.
Deal.
Through the ages is represented. All right. Well, that was, we're doing okay with replacement suggestions here. Now it's going to go a bit off the rails, I'm sure.
Is it me next? Because
Now we're going to jump back to you for the one you have as your number three.
Mm. Okay. My number three is at 217 right now. It's Ankh, Gods of Egypt, published by Simon. Global Limited, designed by Eric Lang, art by Nicholas Fructus, Thierry Masson, and Adrian Smith, published in 2021, I think. So as we all know, I'm going to straight up say what I think it should boot out, and just to upset people a little bit. but if Blood Rage is on there, it can go.
I think it is.
Yeah.
You think it's time?
I think it's time. Yeah. I think Ankh was so good that it showed just the many kind of weird things about games like Blood Rage. And Rising Sun I didn't even like at all. But I thought Blood Rage was fine.
Still never played Rising Sun.
And don't. yeah.
Blood
Rage
is 48, so.
There you go. It can go get replaced by Ankh. It's just a much better game. I like what Eric Lang did with the system, because the whole tension is, you know, like, what are you? It's so generous. Like, whenever you do anything in Ankh, it's like, oh, I can move free things like wherever. Like, it's very, you know, I don't know. It's very fluid, but every action, just for taking the action, you immediately have these, you know, really significant consequences, because every action ticks this marker, and when the marker ticks, like, the event happens, and these events are like so profound and so game warping, and I don't know, and when you get to the combat, and I really like that the combat is just like these big combat rounds where, like, you know, it's thinky, and then wah, you know, all the time, but also thinky, because like one combat influences the next combat, and there's so many intersecting pathways that kind of, like, it feels almost like El Grande in a weird way, where like you have to account for everything that you do, and you have to account for everything that your opponents might do in a way that feels obfuscated and not quite clear. So you have to hedge a lot of bets. So, you know, the excitement of games like Blood Rage, I feel like, is often in these moments of revelation. Oh, like, I played this card, I played that card, you know? This is just more dynamic. There's more layers underneath there. And it's more interesting, you know? I know that Ankh is a bit of a Marmite game, and some people really bounce off of it. Right. But I feel like it's the same with Blood Rage as well, you know? Some people really don't gel with that.
You were just saying with the layers and everything, it was like, the whole time you were talking about Ankh versus Blood Rage, I've actually only played Blood Rage once, and I liked it, but like the way I kind of think of these two, and I don't know if Eric put this into my head or not, but I agree with him, even if he initiated the idea, is that like Blood Rage is more of like a pop album, like, you know, very like commercial rock, you know, it's a people pleaser, whereas Ankh is more progressive. And so when you're talking about these like different layers to it and everything, as you were saying that, I'm like thinking about like a progressive album, how it has this dynamic range. And like lots of different layers and textures to it. So I see them like that. And I think that, you know, this is going to be a controversial discussion, because there's going to be the diehard Blood Rage people are going to be like, no, it's going to have to stay in the slot. And then other people are going to be like, yeah, time to move Ankh in there. Well, oh, that's a good pick. What else are you going to say?
No, that's it, really. I'm sorry. I've bottomed out there, I think.
No, it's cool because I haven't played Ankh in a while, and you know, I had a friend of mine just bring it up maybe like a month or so ago. She's like, "Well, what's that like Egyptian game we played?" Because like I throw a lot of new games at my good friends who are neighbors, and I'm like, "Hey, come try this game." And usually their hearts are broken because I sometimes will only play something once with them. But she was asking me specifically about Ankh, so we'll have to revisit this one too.
It's great, you know. I also really like that it's very good at like almost all the player counts, and the introduction of like a different player count recontextualizes the game again. It's like different at two, it's different at three, it's different at four. I've not played it. I think you can play it with five. I've not played it with five.
I think you can. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Pretty sure you can. But yeah, no. And actually, like for a game that was published through Kickstarter that came out at the same time with expansions, I was surprised with there was one expansion that actually like did gameplay things, right? How good that expansion was, because it actually felt like, oh, this is a whole new game now. I'm playing a different thing. I felt like I was playing El Grande. Now I feel like I'm playing Kemet, right? Like, and I don't mean to invoke Kemet as a, because you know, a similar kind of setting, but they are very different games, but there is that sort of like bigger grandness to it with the expansion. Like there's more kind of layers, feels more meaty. I don't know. Yeah, there's just a lot to like about that game. I think Ankh is special. I think it should be in the top 100.
Cool. And as a just a aside, I've never played Kemet, and I've still always kind of been curious about that too, because I think Eric liked that too. You know, like I think
Kemet's good. It's a good game. Yeah, yeah.
And I love like area control. Like any kind of area control stuff I'm into.
I mean, there's two editions of it, and there's like upsides and downsides to both of them. The rule book in the second edition is unreadable, but otherwise, you know, a pretty solid version of the game. Yeah, you should try it. It's good.
Yeah, it's really on my list to check out at some point. Speaking of area control, the next game on my list is Tyrants of the Underdark. This is a deck building area control game originally released in 2016. They put a new edition out in 2021. It's designed by Peter Lee, Rodney Thompson, and Andrew Veen. And Peter and Rodney are also the two who designed Lords of Waterdeep. And these are both Dungeons and Dragon themed games. You know, I know Lords of Waterdeep, I've only played once, but it's like the classic worker placement game, really clean design. This Tyrants is published by Gale Force 9, plays with 2 to 4 players. And to me, this game, people who listen to this podcast regularly heard me talk about this a couple episodes ago after I played it for the first time. I just think, aside from the cosmetics of it and just like the production, which is like a little I think the game is really awesome, and it's so streamlined, and it's more like it's got Clank complexity deck building, but what you're doing on the board for my taste is way, way better. And it's way more strategic. It's like a war game almost, you know, like the way you're using your cards to make choices of like deploying people, and you're kind of network building because you have to like, you know, but then you can have spies that let you now spawn your troops other places on the board. And you're trying to get to areas or have majority of your troops at different areas for victory points. But then there's also like cool stuff you can do with the different decks of cards. It has, I think, like, I want to say the new version because it includes an expansion, has like 6 or so different decks of cards, and you always mix 2 of them. So that really changes up the feel of the game. But to me, this game just felt like the same feeling when I played like El Grande for the first time. I'm like, it looks dated, but it is so streamlined and like such a clean design. So I want to say, if I was going to replace something, and it'll also like the turns are fast. It's like a 90-minute game. And it just like, it excites me. It looks super dated. Don't get me wrong, because I think they didn't want to change it too much in case people had the old version of the game or something. But I think it could definitely use a new coat of paint.
Mm.
And I feel like that would make it more appealing to the modern day audience if it looked a little different, like the board looks kind of dated. But anyway, so my recommendation for replacement is, are there multiple versions of Clank on the top 100?
Yes, there are. There are two. Okay. There's Clank Legacy Acquisitions Incorporated and the original Clank.
Okay, I'm going to boot out the original Clank because Clank Legacy to me is better than Clank or Clank Catacombs, technically. I would, this is tough. But I would say I would probably boot out original Clank for this.
Okay.
But again, this is going to be my taste because I also like Area Control and like what you're doing. But in terms of two games here that are deck building games that have stuff you're doing on the board, Clank is more like fun, push your luck, kind of hokey or something. Whereas like this is a little more like the second time I played it, our conversation in this four-player game was like we were playing TI. Like, things were tense. Like, you're coming down here? Why are you bringing that troop? You know, and I love that. So, like, that kind of thing excites me. And I feel like it's just a little more strategic than, like, I've had some bad games of Clank where I just got very unlucky. It was, like, very unlucky. I wasn't playing risky or anything, trying to, like, go deep. And it's just like, oh, well, I lost. And somebody else, something happened for them and they got out and they got their 20-point beer and that sucked, you know? Whereas, like, this is more like you're, you know, both games you're choosing which cards you're putting in your deck and how you're, you know, culling your deck and everything. But, like, just what you're doing on the board is way more interesting to me in Tyrants.
I think Clank is fine, so I'm happy with booting it. I have not, but I've heard whispers about this for so long.
Yeah.
And I know that there's people who really, really like this game. And I really need to try this. I'm going to try this.
Yeah, try it.
Yeah. I need to try it. It sounds like my jam. It sounds like my kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm going to go hunt down a copy as soon as we finish recording.
Cool.
Because it sounds really good. I really need to play this.
Yeah. I was just kind of like, it's one of those games for years because I like deck building and I like Area Control that, you know, it fell on my radar and I'm like, I got to play it. They reprinted it. I bought it. It sat in shrink forever and ever. And just a couple months ago, I was like, I want to play this game. Finally did and just loved it. And everybody I played with, like, loved it too. Like, Yeah, I think it's special. Again, you have to kind of go, if you just looked at it, it's kind of dated looking.
Isn't that most board games?
Yeah, it could be spruced up to like, yeah, it could be spruced up, but it doesn't bother me. It doesn't bother me.
No,
so anyways.
I'm going to go get it, but I just need to take off that sign off the door that says no more board games.
No more board games.
It's not going to come otherwise.
All right, Efka, what we got two more each? Yeah, so what's your next game on your list?
So I think this might be the most controversial one because people are going to go, really? And I'm going to say, yes, really. So at number 200 and... Sorry, is that... Yeah, at number 248, published in 2014 by Clask APS... is a game called Clask.
Oh, okay. Dexterity.
Dexterity, designed by Mikkel Bertelsen and art by Mikkel Bertelsen. There is one pure Dexterity game in
Crokinole.
The top 100. Yeah, Crokinole.
Yeah, Crokinole,
and sure, Crokinole, great.
Right.
Fantastic game. No arguments. Love Crokinole, right? Have you seen the price of a Crokinole board?
A lot.
Right?
Yeah,
a lot. Yeah. So Clask is like again, this is something I got a review copy of, so I have to mention that. But Clask is like something like £45 or $50 or whatever it is, right? Like, it's affordable and it's quick. It doesn't take up as much space as a Crokinole board. And I say that as someone who owns, I don't own Crokinole board because I can't afford it, but I own Clask. I own Rod Hockey, like I own a Stiga playoff board, right?
Oh, nice.
I own Karuka, which is like the Karaman snooker thing, right?
Yeah.
I have a lot of these boards, right? So, but Clask takes up the least space and I think is maybe the best out of the pure dexterity games that I own because it's so quick and frenetic and fun. And also, like, there's a lot of skill to it, but it's strangely also really welcoming to new players. Like, you can play Clask against someone who's very good, and you're going to still have a fun time, even if you're losing terribly, because the frenetic pace of it and, like, the ease of execution of the, like, slightly more advanced tricks is so welcoming and so kind of fun and engrossing. And again, cheap, right? Like, you don't have to break the bank to get this. Crokinole is obviously, like, probably the better game out of the two. So I don't know if I can say let's book the Crokinole, because I think it probably deserves being there, but most people cannot afford a Crokinole board. Or, like, they can, but they have to really save up because they are very expensive. I think most people, though, could afford Clask, and it's fun.
So maybe take out another game that has a second edition.
Yeah, right? Like, there's a lot of those, I'm sure.
Yeah. I do own a Crokinole board. I bought one maybe like a couple years ago. I feel like just before there was like this wave of everybody kind of getting into it. And I was like watching videos of people playing professionally. Like, I was super into it for a bit. I'm terrible at it, but I do like, you know, and it doesn't come out that even mine could kind of like hang on the wall somewhere, but it's so huge that we just kind of keep it in the closet. Every once in a while, we'll break it out, put it on like a little table near the game shelf and like have it out for a couple months. But it does take up a significant amount of space. Remind me, like, Clask is, I can picture it. I don't know if I've actually ever played a game of it. Is it like magnet pieces or something on a string or something?
No, there's no string. So there's like a piece made out of two pieses effectively, and they connect via a magnet. One goes on top of the table, one goes underneath the table.
Okay.
And so you control the underneath part, and the top part moves as well because they're connected via a magnet. Right. And all it is a ball, right, on the table, and you have to like flick the ball into the opponent's hole, right?
Okay.
In the goal zone, right? Gotcha. But there's also like these free little magnetic pips that are called biscuits in Clask parlance. And you, if two of them ever attach to your like mover stick thing, magnetic thing, right, you also lose and forfeit a point. And so the brilliant part is that because the biscuits are magnetic and your piece is magnetic, you can actually move those biscuits without touching them if you move the piece fast enough, but like retract it immediately before they connect, right? So there's a lot of like this, and of course you can hit the biscuits with a ball and send the biscuit flying towards your opponent, and if it connects, like, it's hilarious. There's something really, really funny about when that happens. And it's so physical as well, because if you ever move your piece into your old goal zone, because again, it's magnetic, right? It just briefly detaches and then it goes like thud, right? And you're like, ah, no, right? But it's telegraphed immediately with this real like thunk, right? This is something about the physicality of Clask that makes sense, even though it's clearly not like an expensive piece of wood or anything like that. It's just like this little wooden thing, you know, and the board does wear. You have to like treat it, I think, or something, you know. I haven't quite figured that out myself, but you know, it does wear, so it's not like as everlasting as like a Crokinole board.
Yeah, so,
there is that. But it's fun and cheap.
I like how you've been like catering your list and like being like, oh, like what about another dexterity game or another trick taking game? That's cool. That's a good way to think about it. So we have variety of styles of games in there.
I found out what to boot. So this,
what is it?
Eclipse. There's two of them, right?
Oh, there we go. We got another.
The old one can go. Yeah,
the old Eclipse can go.
I'm sure replacing Eclipse with Clask in the top 100 is not going to be controversial to anyone. It's totally fine.
Totally fine.
Yeah.
No riots will start.
No.
So my next game is probably going to be a little bit similar to your Sidereal Confluence situation.
Uh-huh.
Where I think it should be in the top 100. I don't know if everyone will agree, but my pick currently sitting at, or at least 20 minutes ago when we checked, was at 337, and it is The Great Zimbabwe.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah.
So I've never played that particular splatter game, but I understand what's happening.
Okay, so yeah, The Great Zimbabwe is a 2012 splatterspelling game designed by Jeroen Duman and Joris Wersinga, and it plays with 2 to 5 players, and it's this logistics economic game where we're playing basically as tribal leaders in Africa, and we're trying to please gods by building these monuments. And all of this is very abstract and looks very splattery. But to me, this is my absolute favorite splatter game. I know a lot of people are like, oh, food chain, food chain, food chain. But for whatever reason, I like Food Chain. At some point, I was like really excited about it, and I bought the catch-up expansion and never opened it. And I just like, I, for whatever reason, I think maybe, no, I don't fully know, but like The Great Zimbabwe is such a unique game and such a special game. And I think, you know, there are a lot of people who maybe haven't played it, that I definitely like highly recommend playing it. It's got a modular board setup, which not a lot of splatters do. And you have like some of the squares, like the, it's like a grid. But some of the areas will be like water spaces. And then there'll be some like spaces that have like printed resources on them. And you're basically building a network of monuments, and which is putting a disc out on the board somewhere. And you're trying to eventually build more, stack more discs on top of your disc, because each time you build, you make your monument a little higher, you score more victory points from it. But the way that you're doing this is you need to kind of have a, to be in range to different resources on the board. It's very like splattery in that sense. And there are a couple things that like really stand out to me about this game. One is that you are like, there's this really cool bidding system for turn order every round, where your currency in this game are these little cattle tokens. And when you're bidding for turn order, you're actually putting cattle out on these different placards that represent all the players. So turn order is very important because you're sharing resources on the board. So if you're last and you're like, I really need that resource that you and I, Efka, both have, are in range to use, I want to be able to use it first. So like turn order is very important. Managing your economy is really important. But like the one of the coolest things about this game is during the game, you can get these technology cards, you can get these god cards, and you can get these specialist cards. And when you get these, you're going to get this cool special ability. But when you get them, what comes with that special ability is an increased victory requirement. So let's say like everybody starts where our victory requirement is 30 points. Well, if you get to 30 points, you win the game. But guess what? Now I just got this cool god ability. So now that just went up by 5. So now I need to get to 35 points to win the game. So, and you're like, oh, and now I just got this technology. Now I need to get to 38 points to win this game. So you're like, you're weighing like, how much do I want that cool ability versus like, how hard is it going to be for me to now achieve victory? The other thing that's like incredibly awesome about this game is it like you have three actions that you can do, three actions on your turn. Like one is like build a brand new monument. And there's some rules with like placements, like where it can be in relation to other monuments and stuff like that. You can place a craftsman and they're going to be helpful for putting you in range to use resources and getting more resources onto the board. And you can like build up your monument. I don't remember what it's called, but like add a disc to it. But in order to do that, you need to, I think it's like spend, like if I want to move to a second disc on a monument, I need to have access to one type of resource and exhaust it. If I want to build again, now I need to have access to two different resources. Mm-hmm. So you're like doing all this stuff where you're trying to like play strategically and get your turn order and get your money in order. And each game you only play with like a certain amount of either the specialists or the god cards. And they like really like vary things up. And this game is just, yeah, it's just so, so good. And I'm constantly surprised when it's not more people's favorite splatter game like mine. It just has so many clever things going on. I remember getting this and learning it the same year that Barrage came out. And I remember, and I still haven't revisited Barrage. I need to. I know I need to. Everybody tells me I need to. But like when I was playing Barrage in comparison to Great Zimbabwe, I was just like, ew, like there's so many actions. Oh, this isn't like a clean design. But like in like with Great Zimbabwe, I'm like, you do one of three things on your turn. And there's just so many like meaty, rich decisions in every single turn of the game. And it's, oh, it's
that
so,
sounds really
so good.
I like here's so are we booting out Food Chain Magnet out of
people would riot. People would
let's make them riot.
All right, let's boot it out.
So we're officially booting out Food Chain Magnet out of BGG's top 100.
That
now.
Food Chain is the only one that is the only splatter in the top 100, I believe, right?
Mm. Here's my opinion on Food Chain Magnet, right? Like it's a good game. Okay, overall, I think it's a very good game.
Sure.
But I treat it more like an art installation. Like it's cool to experience that. I don't think it as a functional game, it does enough for it to be inviting back, you know?
Mm.
Like you can get good at it, right? But then it becomes less fun to play because unless you're playing it with someone who are like all equally at the same level, it's just like, well, I'm just watching capitalism happen. And I guess I guess it's fun to be a part of that, but maybe not.
It can be a brutal game if you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah, right. So for me, like I enjoyed my, you know, visit to the museum piece, but like it sounds like The Great Zimbabwe is pretty interesting. A lot of board games seem to be revisiting that kind of shared board, shared economy thing. Like I can think of Hamlet that came out recently. I didn't love Hamlet, but it has a similar aspect. And then Kutna Hora as well, you know, like a shared kind of resource thing. So it seems to be like a mechanism that's being re-explored again.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, I just can't tell you, like when the day that I remember I got this from a flea market from someone and it was like, oh crap, I got a copy of The Great Zimbabwe. I mean, since then, I think they reprinted it. But we sat down and all new players played a five-player game of it. It was so good that like half that table was like, they asked to borrow it because I was about to jump. I was at a convention, jump into another game, and they wanted to play it again. And then later that night, it had to have been almost 2 a.m. Things are like winding down at the convention, and three of us who played it earlier were like, "Let's play it again." And we were drinking whiskey, playing it. It took like an hour and a half, I think, but we were just like kept wanting to play it. And now
that sounds pretty good.
Yeah, I think you should try it. I'm very curious to hear when you get to try it what you think about it.
I'll put it on the list.
Yes.
It's going to come together with Tyrants at the Underdark, and I'm going to take the sign off.
Just for a little bit, just so those two games could come in.
Yep.
All right, anyway, that's The Great Zimbabwe. What is the last game on your list, Efka?
So this is at number 482 right now. And I think this is maybe my favorite game on the list, aside from the honorable mention Sidereal Confluence. So this is Pipeline, published in 2019 by Capstan Games, designed by Ryan Courtney, art by Ian O'Toole. We received a review copy back when we accepted review copies. And I love it. It was our game of the year for 2019. And I just feel like Pipeline came and went, and I don't know why. It's such a fantastic design. Have you played it?
I've only played it once, maybe twice, and I really liked it too. And then I got the expansion, and this one I believe I have a review copy of it too. And I've never got the chance to play it with the expansion. But yes, I feel you. Like, it's one of these games that's like so fantastic that just kind of like swept under the rug or something, like people just moved on.
Well, when we did our video, sometimes we gauge interest by, you know, how many views a video gets, because like it's not a precise indicator of anything, because sometimes videos do well for various kinds of reasons, but like the number of views we got on a Game of the Year video was so low, and I was just like, whoa, that people are just not interested in Pipeline for some reason. And maybe it's the setting, because it's like you're trading in oil markets, which, you know, it's not like, it's not the most appealing thing in the world. But like, but the pipes are calling, right? Like, there's pipes in the game, and you tessellate them. And like, you know, you have these like domino pieces full of pipe tubes, and you have to connect them and create this complex, weird, like interconnecting system of flowing oil. And then, you know, if that wasn't enough, there's like a deep economic game underneath all of that, where you're like manipulating markets and trading things. And again, it's also one of the games where like your currency is the victory points, and your like game end scores can vary between like 200 and above 1,000. And that could be like between in the same game between different people, right? So that, and it's happened to me. Like, I played a game where I scored 1,000, someone scored like 250, and then we played another game and I scored like 300, and that person scored like 700 or whatever. So it really fluctuates, right? But what's really cool about it is that it is that dynamic. Right? Not a lot of games allow themselves that space where you can really like push and multiply things and go wild. Mm-hmm. And this lets you do that. And like, it rewards you for spotting these combos, because the actions like are so expensive. You want to achieve so much. They're not expensive in terms of like, oh, it costs me that much to do that. But you're basically, there's a point in the game where up until you reach that point, you never have any money, and taking debts is very bad, and you just don't want to do it. You maybe want to take one debt in the entire game, and the game lets you take like loads of them. And so you're trying, and each action you're trying to squeeze out like just a bit more, just a bit more, just a bit more. And then you reach that critical mass point, and it just goes boom, like everything explodes. And you're in this like mining cart that's got rockets strapped to the back of it, you know, racing down the track, you know, like money's flowing out of your pockets. It can become very explosive. And it doesn't always even do that. Sometimes you end the game without ever having reached that critical point. It's like kind of like your journey. You know, I didn't combine things well enough. I didn't spot the good opportunities. You know, but every action you want to do as much as possible, because you need to reach that critical mass point. It's very intriguing.
I need to revisit this, because I remember like Pipeline was definitely a game where I looked at it and was like, like, it's not going to be for me. I'm not like, are the pipes like polyominoes or...
No, they're not. They're like they're like domino pieces, right?
Yeah. Okay.
Like,
there was something about it where I'm like, oh, like that's not my thing. But then, like, I played the game and I was like, oh, this game is fantastic.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so Ryan Courtney's done a lot of the pipes since then, because he did Curious Cargo, which I didn't think was good, but some people like that game, and I understand why. And then Trailblazers, which was just, it's just the pipes. There's nothing else. It's just
the pipes.
And it's super light, but again, it's got that sort of Calico vibe where it's like very simple, but like super crunchy at the same time in a way that feels painful. Do you know what I mean? Like,
Yeah. Do you know what year did this come out? Was it 2021?
Pipeline 2019.
2019. Oh, wow. Okay. I was going to say, like, I wonder if it just got like lost in the shuffle of like the 2020, 2021 releases where like a lot of people weren't going to conventions. But it's, or maybe people were like me where you kind of looked at it and were like, I don't know if I'll like it.
2019 was a good year for board games. There were a lot of big releases in 2019. It's not 2017. That year was just something else.
Oh, that was pre-me in modern board games, at least.
Yeah, I mean, so that year it was like Spirit Island and Twilight Imperium 4th Edition and Gloomhaven and... yeah, like I think Pandemic Legacy came out in 2017. Like that year was everything, right?
Whoa, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Sidereal Confluence. Best game of all time. Right.
You bringing up Pipeline also made me think of, it's not on my list, but Imperial Steam. I always like, I don't know if you guys ever got a chance to play Imperial Steam, but
played
I always
once,
felt like,
yeah.
I always feel like that one was kind of a little under the radar for heavy Euro gamers too. I thought that was pretty good. But
that really game hurt my brain. I found it hard work.
Yeah.
I found it very hard work. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it was good, but like I was just at the end of it, I was so tired. I felt like I ran a marathon. I was like, I need to go lie down on the bed somewhere.
I know that feeling, and you're totally right, because like I haven't played it in a while because I maybe am thinking that like, oh, like I remember it was kind of a bear to learn also. But and I never got to play that guy's original game Lignum, but I heard that is another like thinky one with like,
yeah, that one's about like wood and stuff, wood, yep. Right? Yeah, I feel like you carried some logs, right?
Yeah, I never got to play it, but you know, maybe one day. But anyways, that's a good pick, and another thing like I'm like, I need to really revisit Pipeline. Because, yeah, I just remember liking it. I don't even think I played it at whatever the ideal player count was. I liked it.
I don't know if there's an ideal player count. Like with four, the market is a lot more dynamic, and that's interesting. But with two, it's much faster. So,
yeah,
you know,
I think I played with two, yeah.
It's good at both, I think. It's different, but it's good at all player counts. I'm going to pick Brass Birmingham to boot out for this. Well, there's two brasses, right? And, you know, both sort of economic games.
There are two in the top 100?
Yeah, there's two in the top. There's Brass Lancashire and Brass Birmingham, right?
And you're keeping
Brass Lancashire at number 20 and Brass Birmingham at number one, you know? So let's take that one. I like, it's great. You know, I love Brass Birmingham.
Keep the controversy coming. Love it.
You know, we need diversity, you know? So yeah, if we're putting in an economic game, let's take one out.
I love it.
Everyone knows Brass Lancashire is better anyway, right? So
I actually have not, I've never played Lancashire. I've only played Birmingham, quite a few times. I can just hear people as they're listening to this between the Ankh and Blood Rage and then that. It's great. We'll have to think about what my boot out is going to be for my last game. My last game is, well, there are two versions. One is ranked 400 something and another is ranked 189. And it is Dune. OG Dune.
Oh, like just Dune.
Force 9.
No colon, no dash, nothing.
No. The Imperiums are already in there, right? Or at least,
yeah.
I don't know if Uprising is yet.
I think Uprising should be in there, and
yeah.
And original Imperium should go away.
Yeah,
but let's forget
kind
about
of a,
that.
Yeah. But yeah. This is, I'm talking about OG just Dune. space.
Do you know if Dune used to be in the top 100 and just left? Or
I would probably imagine it had to be at some time, but I don't know. You know, that like the original version has been around since 1979. And
for a while now, yeah.
Yeah, this is Bill Eberle, Jack Kittredge, and Peter Alotka. And, you know, this game has been around for a while. It's based on Frank Herbert's Dune book. But it's like, to me, for a game that's so old, it's so thematic, and like the asymmetric abilities, how like they tie to like the theme is so cool. And like, I love all of the like negotiation opportunities you have in it. I love the combat system is so cool, where you have this dial and you're kind of like dialing in how many of your soldiers you want to kind of commit to this, but you could throw in treachery cards or have leaders, and then there's traitors and all sorts of things. And it's just like another one of these games that I feel like, even though it's so old, it still feels fresh to play it today.
It's one of those that I know so much about it, right?
Yeah. But
it always evaded me for some reason. I don't know. I've heard, and confirm to me if this is true or not, but I've heard that like your first experience can be very wonky with it, right?
I don't know. I actually haven't heard that, Efka. Like I did not certainly have a wonky experience, but I guess it's like who you play with. Like I was playing with someone who it's like one of his favorite games. He's been playing it forever, and we were all like LARPing it up a bit and into our characters. And so I didn't have like a weird experience, and I don't know. I had never heard that, so I'm not sure about that.
Down the scuttlebutt, I heard that, you know, you can get a faction that is maybe like not as strong if you're playing it for the first time ever.
Oh,
and, you know, like
yeah.
you don't know how to operate it well. And then it kind of, you know,
yeah.
is a long game. You're kind of stuck there. That was my impression. But again, I'm not an expert. I still haven't played it. You know, I'm sure one day I will.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely worth trying at least once if you're like, if you like games that are like, you know, those big, like kind of epic games. Like, yeah, it's not going to take anything like a Twilight Imperium all day thing, but it's probably like a good 4 to 6 hour game, I would say, depending. But yeah, I just love like all of like how thematic it is, how tense things feel when you do combat. And for what it's like kind of doing, it's not overly complex either. Like, I feel like if I was going to, right after we hang up now, go play this game, like it would probably take me like 10 minutes to refresh the rules. You know, like it's not something like, oh, I haven't played Kanban in a while. I need, or on Mars or something where you have to like, you know, it's like there's like a flow. You have phases because it's kind of an old school game. And, oh, get some spice. Oh, move this. You know, like nothing was too crazy that I remember rules wise. But it's more all about like how the players play the game, which I like that stuff.
I actually lied. I said I haven't played it. And that's technically true. I haven't. But I did play there because there's a new
Rex.
No, not Rex. No, 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 no. Gale Force 9, like a couple of years ago.
2019.
Like literally a couple of years ago.
Their short version of it.
Yes, yes, yes. I played that.
I forget what that's called. Like,
no idea.
But I played that too. And yeah, that's like a very like stripped down kind of version of it. Yeah, that was fine.
I thought that was fine. That was my impression of it. And I played it with someone who knew Dune very well.
Yeah.
Like played it like 100 times kind of played this game, you know, well. And they gave me context for like, well, you know, in the big game, this would be completely different, you know. And I was like, oh, okay, understand. So I got a feeling of a very kind of stripped down thing. And I think maybe the stripped downness didn't do it much favor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think I played the stripped down one before I actually played the Big Daddy one. Mm. And Wow, I totally forgot about that version.
Right? Like, yeah, it took me a second to remember that I actually played that, you know? Yeah. It came and went. I was
it
like,
came and went as another was, one.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, I think I would assume probably at some point some version of the original Dune was in the top 100. And I just think it's like what stood the test of time, you know?
Mm.
And yeah, like I think it's something I'll still be playing.
I think there's something to be said about a game from like older than me, right?
Right. Both of us. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Both of us put together and our parents, yeah. Right? Like, so old.
Yeah. Yeah.
Still around, right?
Still around. Wow. Yeah. Anyways, the other games that I was just thinking about, which aren't like full-fleshed honorable mentions. Go ahead.
What are you replacing?
What am I replacing? Oh, my goodness. Are there like two versions of Mansions of Madness or something on there?
Oh, go on, be spicy. I booted out Ross Birmingham.
Technically, I should take out the Eclipse, the first version of Eclipse. I guess I can't take out TI. Like, I cannot take out TI. Yeah. And I'm thinking on the terms, like, of vibe, it's in that vein. But I can't take TI. I can't do that.
What about a thematic space game? You know, what about like Nemesis is on there? You could boot out Nemesis.
Oh, I like Nemesis also. Oh, they're different. They're different feels. Efka.
They're different. Okay. They're different enough.
So, okay. So now I'm going to cheat and I'll do War of the Ring, the first edition. That's coming out.
Okay. Fair enough. Fair enough.
Not as gutsy, but hey, well, look, we made room for all of our games here. That's pretty good. We had a total of nine swapperoonies since we overlapped on the one.
I mean, that's a much better top 100 now, right? And you know, as a BGG person, you obviously have the power to make these changes official.
As soon as I disconnect from this call, I'll go and type away and make it happen. So by the time people hear this episode, they'll have a fresh Efka Candace version of BGG's top 100.
We're going to have a new number one, right?
Pipeline, was it?
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Efka, this has been great. Oh, I was going to say too, the couple that I was thinking about that I had on my consideration list was Great Western Trail in New Zealand, Blood on the Clock Tower, and Glory to Rome. I was kind of...
They all make sense. Yeah, they all make sense. But Glory to Rome, I think, would be cheating because that game technically doesn't exist anymore. So,
yeah.
You know, it's a historical item rather than, you know, a game to be on a top 100.
Exactly.
Yeah, but I can see the other two, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, Great Western Trail, it's...
I don't know. I know. Mm. One of them should be on there. I don't know. Maybe we just keep the original for now.
I mean, this is difficult because, like, I like some of the changes that New Zealand made to the deck building, mm-hmm. right? But I didn't love the expanded whole, like, you know, what used to be the train board. They went too far there. There was too much.
It's like an expansion, right?
Yeah, right? Yeah. Like, whereas Great Western Trail, you know, I played it again recently. It's still pretty great.
Yep.
Believe it or not, still pretty great.
That trail is amazing. Yep.
Yeah. So I don't know which one of them should be on there.
Yeah. Well, that's why it didn't make my list, because I don't know how strongly I feel about that right now. But yeah, you're right. Like, I wonder if there was something that had the deck building enhancements of New Zealand, but without the seaboard, back to a more like trainee situation.
Yeah. Also, you know, I'm glad you mentioned Blood on the Clock Tower. I don't think, I mean, unless you count Battlestar Galactica, I don't think there is a social deduction board game.
Avalon, not up there.
I don't know if it is. Is Avalon? Well, no, there's Tainted Grail, the fall of Avalon, but I don't think that counts.
Interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
No, yeah, Battlestar Galactica is the only one.
Oh, yeah. Resistance Avalon is $199. Wow. Mm. All right. Well, got to figure out something to put Blood on the Clock Tower in there. Well, I can't get rid of Blood, or I can't get rid of Battlestar, though.
No, yeah.
I do love Battlestar.
That makes sense. It's a long, enduring game. People love it despite it being unavailable, right? You know? and you know, Unfathomable didn't make, like, that, you know, didn't get there.
Yeah, it didn't get there for me either. Don't know. But anyways, you and I could keep talking forever.
I feel like we could, yeah.
And well, maybe we need to, we'll have to revisit this topic in a year or so.
See how people feel about our changes, right?
Exactly. Get some, like, live callers on.
Uh-huh.
To give us their thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, but anyways, Efka, it was great to see you and talk to you, and I hope to catch you, you know, at Essen, I guess, maybe. I don't
Essen
know if you're
Spiel,
coming
right?
to Gen Con or anything.
I'm not coming to Gen Con, but I will probably be going to Essen Spiel.
Okay, all right. Well, we'll have to get some, play some shedding games or something. Some tricky
games. Oh, yeah.
Games.
Oh, that sounds great.
Hotel
that
lobby
really
trick takers. Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you again.
And, Candice, thank you so much
for
having me on.
Send my love to Elaine also.
I will do.
You've been listening to the Board Game Geek podcast, produced and edited by Candice Harris. Special thanks to Matt Fonda for editing and mixing our music. Be sure to visit us on the web at BoardGameGeek.com. You can also find us on YouTube, Twitter, Blue Sky, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and Twitch under Board Game Geek. You can reach us by email at podcast@BoardGameGeek.com. Thanks for listening, and happy gaming!